And then let's cultivate our motivation. And think for a minute of all the countless living beings throughout the universe, different places, having different experiences with different bodies and different realms of existence. And that all of this is caused by afflictions and karma. And so all these sentient beings who want to be happy still find themselves in unsatisfactory conditions with either the dukkha of pain, dukkha of change, and then everybody experiencing pervasive conditioned dukkha. And so let a feeling of compassion arise for ourselves and others, because we're all in the same boat. And all these sentient beings have been kind to us in previous lives and will continue to be kind to us. And so let's have compassion for everybody. And let that compassion motivate us to go beyond our own limitations, our own wrong views and wrong conceptions, so that we have a strong determination to understand the nature of reality and use that to cleanse our mind of all defilements and their seeds and their stains, so that we can become fully enlightened Buddhas who are most capable of benefiting all living beings. So let's make that our long-term motivation for being here today. So now I'm going to try and talk to all my mothers and fathers from previous lives. That's what I think when I give Dharma talks, because my parents of this life weren't interested in the Dharma. So then I say, well, my parents of previous lives and future lives are, so I'll talk to you. And then hopefully in future lives, my parents of this life will be more receptive to the Dharma and be able to help them in the Dharma then too. You know, because you can see how much is up to karma, isn't it? You know? It's so much is determined by karma. You know, previous inclinations as to what we're attracted to, what we're not, what we're open-minded towards, what we're not interested in, what we are interested in. You know, we don't come in as blank slates. And so, of course, our present life conditioning affects us. But, you know, and then once we're adults, if we're fortunate enough to hear the Dharma, we can start reconditioning our minds. But we really see that you know, things are very much influenced by our past intentions. Mm-hmm. So when you see this kind of thing, you know, because it's so interesting, isn't it? You know, here are two people, the parents of this nutty Buddhist nun, and, you know, and they aren't interested in the Dharma. You know, and yet I was born their child, and you know, became a Buddhist nun. Why in the world did that happen? You know, that wasn't what they had planned for. Yeah. So you can see that there's, you know, a lot of other influences going on. And so that's why it's so important, you know, once we hear the Dharma, as much as possible to really start watching our mind and differentiate between, you know, what is virtuous and wholesome, what is not, and then really try as much as possible to put our mind in a good space to create more of that imprint so that that virtuous imprint will ripen in future lives. So it doesn't matter how old we are when we start practicing. The idea is, however old we are, to practice, okay? Because the mind stream is a continuity that goes on, and why we have this precious human life with the opportunity we have is really something quite precious, and we don't know if we'll have this kind of opportunity and chance again. And you can see even in this life, circumstances can change. You know, people may have very strong intentions to practice Dharma, and then, you know, all sorts of things happen. Yeah. I have one friend who, really very brilliant woman and an incredible translator, and she was walking, you know, in a car park, and you know the things that come down? One of those came down and hit her on the head, and you know, her mental capacities are very much impaired now. Mm-hmm. So even though she had the intention, the love of the Dharma, had loved the Dharma, everything like that, one small incident and her ability to practice in this life is kaput. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why, you know, as long as while we have our health, while we have the ability to learn, you know, and to practice and to reflect on things, instead of just taking it for granted, thinking, oh, I'm always going to have this opportunity, I'll do something else now and then I'll come back to the Dharma later. We don't know if we're going to be able to come back later, because we don't know, you know, what's going to happen later on in this life. And so that's why it's really important to cherish our opportunity and make good use of it while we have it. And if we think like that, in that kind of way, then our life actually becomes quite joyful and quite meaningful. And Dharma practice doesn't seem like a burden. It seems like, wow, I am so lucky, you know. I am so lucky that I have my mental and physical capacities that I can wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and meditate, you know. Instead of, oh, 5 o'clock, who are they kidding? Okay? But to really see our fortune having this opportunity. And, you know, instead of like, oh, I've got to go listen to another teaching, my back hurts, my knees hurt, I, you know, I want to go to the movies. You know, instead of thinking like that, really, you know, seeing, because we don't know how long we're going to have this opportunity, do we? You know, we really don't know. And so if we see the opportunity as something very precious, then, like I said, our life becomes quite meaningful and joyful. And we want to take the opportunity, and it's not a burden. And it's not, oh, I have to do this, or this is too hard. I'm dragging myself to enlightenment. Because I'm supposed to, and I ought to, and I should, and everybody's going to judge me if I don't get enlightened for them. You know? And instead of looking at things like that, our mind is really quite happy, and like, wow, you know, I have a precious opportunity, and I don't know how long it's going to be, yeah, in this life or future lives. And it took me, I did a lot of things good in previous lives to get the opportunity I have now. You know, one of the inmates that I write to, he said that, you know, it really enters his mind when he's practicing, and practicing in prison is not especially easy, you know, is that he realizes that whoever he was in previous lives created a lot of causes for him to have this opportunity, and he doesn't want to blow it, you know, for whoever he was in a previous life that worked so hard. And so he feels like he really wants to practice now. So, you know, if we have that kind of thing, then our attitudes are different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes when we're around the Dharma a lot, we become saturated, and we take things for granted, and then it's like, oh yeah, I heard this teaching before. Yeah, impermanence, yeah. Yeah, precious human life. Oh, there they go again. You know? And we come like that. You know, we become really saturated. And we take the experience for granted. So it's important to make our mind fresh. I think when in the Zen tradition, when they talk about beginner's mind, this is what they're talking about. You know, come in and your mind is fresh. Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, this is great. Yeah, and then you're open-minded and you take it in and you're eager. Yeah. So that fresh mind, that beginner's mind, that isn't saturated and exhausted. I'm so tired of serving sentient beings. They say it's going to be easier at enlightenment, but I don't know. You know, just think of, you know, how precious this opportunity is to serve sentient beings. We don't always have an opportunity to serve sentient beings, do we? Sometimes we're in too much pain ourselves, you know, in another realm. Or the mind's too obscured with stupidity in another realm. We're too obscured with sense pleasure in another realm. And we don't have the opportunity to serve sentient beings. So we should take the opportunity while we have. Okay, back to the four seals. So, you know, when the Buddha was saying that all phenomena, all contaminated phenomena are dukkha, you know, that's said in relationship to the mind, okay? Because the mind that is creating and perceiving these phenomena, it is a mind that is tainted by ignorance. Okay? And so in the Dasabhimaka, the Ten Grounds Sutra, the Buddha said the three realms are only mind. Okay, it's a very famous quote. The three realms of existence, desire realm, form realm, and formless realm, are only mind. And so there began a school of philosophical thought called the Chittamatras, or the mind-only school. And they take this quotation quite literally and say that the objects we're perceiving, plus the perceiving mind, all originated from the same substantial cause, which was an imprint on the mind. So they say there's no externally existent objects, but things arise due to imprints on the mind. Okay. There comes some glitch holes in that philosophy when you start to debate and ask some questions. So the Prasangika Majjhimaka school, which is said to be the most accurate of the philosophical systems, they don't interpret the three realms, our only mind, to mean that the object and subject both arise out of the same karmic imprint. But they take that to mean that there's no absolute creator, but that things are created by the karma and the afflictions on the mind stream, by our intentions, by our attitudes. In saying that, it doesn't mean that our mind is the only thing that creates things, yeah, because we can get very confused in that way, yeah, because there are external phenomena, okay, there is an external world, there are external phenomena. I should try and speak proper English. yeah, but the things that that arise. You know, we have the physical cause and effect system of physics, the biological cause and effect system of organic biology, other kinds of the psychological cause and effect, okay, and the karmic cause and effect. There's many different kinds of causality. And so the way that afflictions and karma cause phenomena is not that we produce the karma produces the metal that the bowl's made out of, or the ceramic that the cup is made out of. It's not like that. The mind doesn't create the material. Don't get confused. But rather there's an intersection between the mind's intentions and these other systems of cause and effect that occur. So that at the evolution, at the time of the evolution of the universe, you know, the karma of the sentient beings who are going to be born there influences the physical development of the universe, but the physical laws of seeds growing into sprouts and oxygen and hydrogen combining to make water, these kinds of laws still function. Okay, so don't think that this quotation, don't go back to the Chitta Madra view and think that there's nothing outside and, you know, only the mind, the karma functions to create things. Yeah, but there's an intersection there. But the thing is, how we experience things, the way in which we experience them, depends a lot on our karma. So, for example, the system of physical causality may make there be an earthquake. Okay, that depends on the law of physics and all the scientific laws, whether the earth is going to move when it has so much tension and some such things. But us being there when the earthquake is happening is influenced by our karma and our actions. And if we're there when the earthquake is happening, whether we're injured or not injured in the earthquake is dependent upon our karma. Okay? So there's this intersection there between the different systems. Okay? And so our karma is quite important. And like I was saying, we have physical, verbal, and mental karma. Yeah? And the subtlest of those is the mental karma, because we have to have a mental intention before the mouth moves or the body moves. Okay? So when we take precepts, we start with controlling our physical and verbal behavior before controlling our mental behavior, because that's easier. Okay? Yeah, it's harder to control our intentions, but sometimes we can catch it before the intention becomes speech or the intention becomes physical action. So at the first level, when we are taking precepts, we take the pratimoksha, or individual liberation precepts, that have to do with our physical and verbal actions. Okay? Of course, to keep those precepts well, we have to start working with our mind. But we don't break the precepts unless there's been a physical or verbal action. Okay? We don't break them completely unless there's been a physical or verbal action. With the bodhisattva and tantric vows, on the other hand, those are higher levels of vows. Some of those, not all of those, can be broken just by the mind itself without the mouth or the body doing anything. Okay, so those systems of vows are much more difficult to keep. Okay, but we can see here how the mind is involved with creating our unsatisfactory conditions, because it's the mind and the ignorance that keeps us involved in cyclic existence. Okay, because especially, during our lives we create all sorts of karma. Yeah, because we have all sorts of intentions. And so what we want to be on the lookout for is at least not to create the very heavy, complete karmas. Okay, so a complete karmic action is one where you have the object, you have a motivation to do it, there's the action, and then there's a completion of the action. Okay? So, for example, in killing, which is the first one that we're advised not to abandon, you know, there's someone that you want to kill, there's the motivation to do it, and there's an affliction behind that motivation. Then there's the action of killing, and then there's the completion of the action, which is the other person dies before you do. Okay? So likewise with the 10 non-virtues, we have killing, stealing, and unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Those are three physical ones that we want to abandon. Okay? And then four verbal ones, lying, using our speech to create disharmony and division, harsh words, and then idle talk. And then three mental ones, which are coveting and ill will or malice and wrong views. And those are very well-developed mental states. Okay, so it's not just a passing thought of attachment, but you're really dwelling on the thing you're attached to, so you really covet it. Yeah, it's not a passing thought of anger, but it's really sitting down and plotting your revenge, you know, and having ill will. It's not a passing confused thought, but it's a very stubbornly held wrong view, okay, that makes the mind very closed. Yeah, so we want to avoid those kinds of actions, because they put, when they're complete, with all the factors complete, they put the seeds on our mind stream. And then what happens is at the time of death, yeah, we all have, you know, how we have it planned out, right? You have your own little death scene all planned out, the perfect way you want to die. You ever thought about it? How many people have thought about their perfect death scene, how they want to die? You know? Okay, so we have our little perfect death scene. Forget it. Yeah. That's just, you know, our grasping that thinks that we can control the world. Yeah. And we're going to control all the people around us. What our mind's thinking is, you know, I've been trying to control everybody my whole life, and they haven't cooperated, at least at the time of death. You know? Then I'll be successful. They'll do it because they'll know I'm dying, you know? Forget it, folks. Okay, we're not going to be able to control other people at the time of death. And the question is, are we going to be able to control our own mind at the time of death? Okay, can we control our own mind while we're doing the breathing meditation for 10 minutes? You know, we can't, can we? Our mind is like all over the place. So thinking that we're going to have this perfect death scene where we're going to be in complete control and everybody else is going to finally do what we want them to do, it's not going to happen, okay? Because we can't, if we can't do it while we're alive, how are we going to do it when everything's so confused and we realize we're departing from this life? You know? And people tell me, oh, I want to practice dream yoga. Yeah. But if we can't focus our mind when we're awake, how are we going to do it when we're dreaming, when we have less control? You know, just think about it. We've got to be practical. No? Okay, get, you know, all the airy-fairy ideas we have. You know, we've got to get our feet on the ground here. Okay, so what happens at the time of death is, you know, there's something called the 12 links of dependent origination, which actually comes in the Heart Sutra, you know. But that's later, when the Heart Sutra. But the 12 links of dependent origination, they talk about how we are born and die and born and die again and again and again. And what happens at the time of death, okay, is craving arises. Now, we have a lot of craving while we're alive, don't we? We crave a ton of different things. At death time, we crave to remain in this body. We crave this life. We crave the familiarity of our idea of who we are and of everybody we're attached to and the whole scene we're in, even though it's unsatisfactory, even though it's miserable, we don't know anything else, and we're terrified of separating from it. Because if I don't have this body, who am I going to be? And if I'm not in this particular social situation with people relating to me in this way and me relating to them in that way, who am I going to be? And if I don't have these possessions that, you know, describe my self-image, who am I going to be? So there becomes a lot of strong craving at the time of death. This craving starts to, it acts as the water and fertilizer on some of the karmic seeds and makes them start to ripen. Okay? So it's going to focus, the seeds that are most likely to focus are the ones where we have a complete virtuous or non-virtuous action. Okay? Yeah. And if when we're craving, if there's also, you know, a lot of just, you know, holding on to this life, or maybe the mind is angry, you know, we're dying and we're angry at the doctors because they aren't God and they haven't saved us, or we're angry at our relatives because something they did 30 years ago, you know, whatever it is, and we die with that anger, that's going to, you know, act as fertilizer for a negative karmic seed to ripen. If we die with a mind that is rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and a mind of kindness, that will make a positive karmic seed, you know, seed start to ripen. But, you know, to have a virtuous mind at the time of death, we're very much creatures of habit. So that means training our mind to have a virtuous, wholesome attitude while we're alive. And so we just have to look at our mind and say, how often do I have a virtuous attitude compared to how often am I grumbling and griping and angry and vindictive and, you know, like that. Or just plain old spaced out, you know, zoned out on the TV and the internet and the drugs and alcohol and the driving around because we don't know what to do. Okay? So we're very much creatures of habit. We have to ask ourselves how we're living, because that's going to influence how we die. So we have the craving. At a certain point, it becomes evident to us we're not going to be able to hold on to this life. So then what we do is we grasp to have another life. Okay, if I got to separate from this one, I want another one. I want another ego identity. Okay? You know, because this self-grasping at this big I, you know, me, I am here. And there's this feeling like you're going to go out of existence because the mind is changing, that you're separating from the body. So there's this fear, you know, I'm just going to cease to exist. So then there's this grasping that I want to exist. I have to exist. A body is going to make me exist. Okay? Or some kind of ego identity is going to make me exist. And so that grasping, together, the craving and grasping, they really act as the fertilizer that makes a previously created karmic seed start to ripen. Okay? That karmic seed, as it's starting to ripen, is the tenth link, which is called existence, which is giving the name of the result to the cause, because even though you haven't been reborn yet, that seed is going to create another existence in samsara. And then as that seed is ripened at a certain point, you know, when it becomes possible to enter into a new body, boing, there we go. Okay? And then the next life begins. And so we're reborn again and again and again. Yeah, in this way, without end, as long as ignorance is there. Okay? Because ignorance is the root of it. Okay. So we talked a little bit yesterday how ignorance is the root of it. Let's approach it from a little bit of a different way today. Okay. we can see that a lot of greed and clinging attachment and anger, that those things cause suffering. Right? Would people agree with that? You know, that when you have a lot of clinging, your mind is just clinging and sticky and greedy, it causes suffering. Yeah. When the mind is angry and hostile, it causes suffering. Okay. Now, how do those attitudes or those mental states, those emotional states of attachment and anger arise? What are they based on? What fuels them? How come they're there? Okay. So when we look, yeah, let's look at attachment, first of all. Okay. Let's say I'm attached to my flowers. Okay. So, you know, flowers, this, I'm just saying flowers because they're here. This could be your car. This could be your partner. This could be your kids. This could be your social status. It could be your body. It could be whatever it is. Okay. I'm attached to my flowers. Well, before actually somebody gave me the flowers, they're just flowers growing in a garden. I'm not especially attached to them. Yeah. When you're walking through the garden, you know, you enjoy them, they're pretty. But there's not this sense of, you know, they belong to me. As soon as somebody gives me the flowers, like as soon as we buy the car, as soon as we get engaged, as soon as the baby comes out, as soon as we get the promotion, as soon as we get the trophy or the acknowledgement, whatever it is, then the thing becomes mine. Okay. So mine. What happens when I label things mine? Yeah, there's a big distinction between others and me, what belongs to you and what is mine. Because if it's mine, it's not yours. And you better be very careful of how you relate to things that are mine, because if you interfere with the things that are mine that give me happiness, whether it's a person or a situation or praise or reputation or material possessions, if you interfere with it, look out. Okay. Now, has anything actually happened to the flowers themselves from their side, from when they were in the garden to when they became mine? They got cut. But, you know, they're still this kind of this, basically the same flowers, aren't they? You know, okay, changing, they're more wilted now than they were there. But, you know, they're basically, there's not been any big physical thing that's, you know, changed the nature of the flowers. But what happened? The mind labeled mine. Okay? So it's just a label. Mine. Mine is just a concept. There is nothing inside these flowers that make them mine. Is there? You send them to a lab to be tested? Are they going to find mine inside there? Are they going to find these belong to Thupten Chodron inside those flowers? No. It's just a label that we've given to the flowers. But that label has a lot of meaning. And what gave that label the meaning? Our mind. Our mind gave that label the meaning. Okay? So when I call it mine, it becomes a big deal. So there's some grasping there at me, isn't there? There's already some grasping at this notion of a real, solid, truly existent me who now has become the owner of these. And somehow, mystically, magically, I have permeated these flowers with mineness that they inherently have. Okay? And so because of that, because they're mine now, I'm very attached to them in a way that I wasn't attached to them when they were in the garden. And then when people interfere with my flowers, okay, I get upset because there's this real me who's deriving real pleasure out of these real flowers, and a real you is interfering with them. Okay? So then anger arises. So you can see that below the attachment and below the anger, there's this notion of a real, solid, truly existent me who's there. Okay? So that is called self-grasping of persons. Self-grasping of persons. When I, that's the grasping at I and mine, the self-grasping of persons. Yeah. When I'm looking at the flowers and I think they have some essence on their own, they truly exist, or my body truly exists, or something like that, that's called self-grasping of phenomena. So self-grasping of phenomena means all the other things that are existent beside persons. Okay. Now, we have to look at the wording here, because we have self-grasping of persons. And person, in one way of using the word self, self, person, I, all these things are synonymous, aren't they? The self is the person. We each have a self, okay? So self-grasping of person, but self-grasping of phenomena? So the word self has different meanings in different contexts. And this is quite important, and if you remember it, it'll save you a lot of confusion. Okay? That the word self has different meanings in different contexts. So when we're talking about myself, ourself, my I, your I, the capital I, okay? That way, self is synonymous with persons. But in another context, self means the object that is negated in the meditation on emptiness. In other words, self means inherent existence. Self means the fantasized way of existing that we have projected onto people and onto things. So when we talk of the self of person, it means the inherent existence of persons. When we say the self-grasping of phenomena, it's a grasping at inherent existence of phenomena. Okay. And so similarly, when we generate wisdom, that realizes there's no such self, no such inherent existence exists, that becomes the selflessness of persons, or the selflessness of phenomena. Okay? So you have to figure out what self means in different contexts. It would be so easy, wouldn't it, if a word only had one meaning in, you know, in each, it only had one meaning, period. We'd avoid a lot of confusion. But even in English, things have multiple meanings. One word has multiple meanings. That sometimes make it very, very confusing. Okay? Yeah? Like the word sanction. This word always puzzles me. Sometimes sanction means, you know, you set up sanctions and you're not going to do business with somebody. Sometimes sanction means you approve. So it has two opposite meanings. Doesn't it? You know, it's very confusing. I can't even figure it out. Okay. So, as we move into the third of the four seals, okay, empty and selfless, yeah, we're coming into the meaning of empty and selfless. Now, since the four seals, we're going to get a little bit into the tenet systems here, but not too much. Since the four seals are principles that are accepted by all Buddhists, you know, and I mentioned before that within Buddhism there's different tenet systems, so there's sometimes different beliefs and different assertions about the nature of reality. So since in general the four seals are accepted by all the traditions, then the common meaning of empty in terms of the four seals is that there is no permanent, partless, independent self or person. We talked about that yesterday. And then selfless means there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent person, which is the person that's the controller. Okay? So that's the commonly accepted things by all the Buddhist tenet systems. The Prasangika Madhyamaka actually have a different assertion, and while they refute a permanent, partless, independent self and a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, they say that both of those are gross levels of fantasized meaning, and that actually the subtlest level is an inherently existent self, not only of the person, but also of phenomena. So from a Prasangika viewpoint, empty and selfless have the same meaning of the lack of inherent existence. There's a bunch of terms there. Let's go back and kind of unpack them. Yeah. When you're first learning this, you know, you have to learn the terminology. And it can be very confusing at first. But, you know, we're not expected to understand everything the first time we hear it. But if you can get some kind of an idea and learn the terminology, and then the next time you learn a little bit more, it becomes a little bit clearer, you have a better idea what the conception means, then the next time you hear it, you can pay more attention to different kinds of things. Okay? So don't get worried if everything's not completely clear the first time you hear it. You know, it's expected that this is going to take repeated listening, which is why we listen to the Dharma repeatedly. And we, you know, it's why it's not so good to say, oh, I've heard that teaching before I got it. Because we just might not. Okay? So the permanent, partless, independent self, yeah, that is the very gross object of negation, the very gross object of person that we're saying does not exist, is the idea of a soul or a self that is totally separate from the body and the mind. Okay? And it's an idea. It's not, there's different levels of misconception, different levels of grasping. Some grasping is innate. It goes with us from life to life. So even animals and, you know, all beings have it. Some grasping we human beings create with our conceptual mind. And that's called acquired grasping or acquired ignorance, because we acquire it through learning incorrect philosophies or incorrect theories, incorrect psychologies. So this idea of a soul, permanent, partless, you know, unitary, independent of causes and conditions, yeah, that soul is an idea that we human beings have created. It's not even an innate grasping that goes with us from life to life. But you can see how we talked yesterday, how we got this thing instilled in us when we're little, And, you know, and we believe in it, and it provides a lot of emotional comfort. And we can think of all sorts of reasons why such a soul exists, you know. God created it, there's an absolute creator, God created this. We have a soul that, you know, is beyond the body and mind, does not depend on causes and conditions, that even when the body falls apart and we lose our mind, the soul is still there and the soul gets reborn somewhere. Okay? So we can make up a whole religious system or philosophical system based on that idea. Okay? But as we did yesterday, if we really examine, can there be a self that is permanent and unchanging, you know, that becomes very, very difficult. Yeah. So even though sometimes we have the idea there's this permanent self that just kind of bumps into things, actually when we think about it, we realize that everything we bump into, we change due to, don't we? Mm-hmm. You know, we are a conditioned phenomena. We don't think of ourselves when we say I. We don't think I am a conditioned phenomenon. I exist only due to causes and conditions. We don't have that feeling. No. Okay. To think of the self that is unitary without any parts, that doesn't have a body, that doesn't have a mind, that is something separate from those, you know, that also very difficult to sustain when we analyze it. To think of a self that doesn't depend on causes and conditions, that's not created, that doesn't change moment by moment. You know, when we examine, yeah, we change moment by moment. Okay? So that idea, all the Buddhist systems agree that that kind of self doesn't exist. Okay? And that was the self that was propounded by many of the non-Buddhist philosophical systems at the time of the Buddha. And when you read the Pali scriptures, you'll see the Buddha's always engaging in dialogue with these people. And let's have a debate and see and really talk about it. And explaining why that kind of thing can't exist. Because people at the time of the Buddha, they were also asking, you know, is the universe infinite or finite? Is the Tathagata, the Buddha, permanent or impermanent? Is the self permanent? Yes, very similar kinds of questions. Okay, then, so we negate that one. Then, selflessness refers to the lack of, this is the common understanding for all Buddhist schools, selflessness means the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay, what that means, whenever I write this in my autocorrect thing, I have S-S-S-E, self-sufficient, substantially existent, so I don't have to type it out each time. It's an autocorrect. Self-sufficient, substantially existent. Okay. Yeah. So this is a person, yeah, the feeling of I that we have that controls. Yeah. The I is a controller of the body and mind. It is self-sufficient. It's substantially existent. It's there and it controls the body and mind. Okay? So it's kind of mixed in with the body and mind. It's not seen as a separate soul. It's kind of mixed in with the body and mind, but it's the ruler. Okay? And so this is the one that, just the one that controls, that thinks we can control our body, that thinks we can control our mind. And when we look, is there any kind of self that exists like that, that's kind of, you know, separate and can control the body and mind? There isn't such a self. Okay? All we find is a body and a mind. We don't find any super thing above and beyond it that's controlling it. Okay. Now, from the viewpoint of the Prasangika, negating these two, the permanent, partless, independent, and the self-sufficient, substantially existent person, that's not sufficient. Prasangika says negating those are steps on the way, but underlying both of those wrong conceptions of the person, or wrong graspings of the person, is the notion that there's some objectifiable locus for who we are. Some essence that is really me. Something that when you take everything away, it's truly the essence of me-ness. Okay? So this, the inherently existent I, okay, or it's also called the I that exists from its own side. It exists from its own side without depending on being labeled by the mind. Okay? It has its own inherent nature that doesn't depend on anything conceptualizing it and giving it a label and creating it in that way. But rather, it radiates its own inherent nature, something that makes it it, from its own side, without depending on the mind. Okay? Now, when we look around and we look at things, we don't think, you know, when we look at the flower, it seems like there's a flower in there, isn't there? Yeah, there's a flower essence. We don't look at the flower and think that flower depends on being mentally labeled, do we? You know, we just think there's a flower there. Okay, there. There's something in this that makes it a flower independent of the mind. Yeah? But when we examine, you know, here's another terminology, the basis of the label, okay? So this thing is called the basis of the label. It's the collection of parts. Okay? The basis of designation, basis of the label. Okay? They all mean the same thing. Okay? Basis of designation. This is the basis of designation. It's the collection of the parts. Okay? But is the collection of parts itself sufficient for this to be a flower? If we separated all the parts and put the petals here and the stamen and pistils and all those other things that I learned in fifth grade and I forgot what they mean now. Oh, you put all those other things there piled in a heap. Is that the flower? It's not. But has anything been added to that collection of parts when it's put in this shape? No, it's just a rearrangement of the parts. So this shape, this configuration itself, isn't the flower. It's when our mind looks at it, picks out these things as details, conceptualizes this as a thing, and gives it the name flower. At that point, it becomes a flower. Okay, hold on right now. Okay, becomes a flower at that point. So there's nothing in it that actually makes it a flower. But its being a flower depends on our mind labeling it. And this thing being able to perform the function that we're assigning, the meaning that we're assigning to that word. Okay? Yeah. We could call this ikidu, Okay? Yeah. So, I mean, in another language, you could call it ikkidu. Yeah. But it could be an ikkidu as long as it performs the function of what you're assigning the sound ikkidu to mean. Okay? So, in other words, we can't call anything we want to and change it and make it into that. But something doesn't become that until we give it that name and believe it to be that way. And to me, this fits in with the little bit I know about early childhood development and early childhood perception, that when babies are born, you know, babies' perception, there's just kind of colors and sounds and everything's mixed up. You know, and when a baby cries, the baby doesn't know that it's making the sound. Yeah? So babies, when they hear themselves cry, will often get frightened by the sound. They don't have the concept, I'm making this sound. And when the babies lie in their crib and there's these little things floating above them, you know, they don't have the idea, oh, there's an angel, oh, there's a frog, you know? When babies see their mother and father, they don't have any idea of what mother means or what father means. They don't think my body came from these people. Yeah. They don't even necessarily, you know, I mean, all they know is, oh, there's warmth, there's comfort, there's food. Okay, but they don't have the conceptualization in their mind of all these being discrete objects. And when the baby looks at a flower, you know, besides, you know, it doesn't have the language to label it flower, but it doesn't even have the idea that this is a discrete object because all the colors are blurred together. You know, the color of the flower is blurred with this and that, and the baby doesn't know which things are in the foreground, which are in the background, yeah, which things belong together. And so the process, as we get older, you know, as the baby grows up, is we develop a lot more conceptual ability, okay, and we begin to put pieces together and make them into objects. Okay? And then we give them labels, and then they come to function, you know. We have a definition, we have a label, it's kind of societally agreed upon most of the time, but when it isn't, we quarrel about it. Okay? And we create these objects, and then we impute more and more and more meaning on all these things. This flower is beautiful. This flower is mine. This flower gives me pleasure. This flower symbolizes how successful I am as a human being. Okay, we impute so much meaning onto it. But the flower in itself completely lacks all that meaning of attachment and aversion that we put on it. And it even lacks having the essence of flower itself. Okay? So the example, when we talk about things being merely labeled, that is very often given, is the presidency, okay? That, you know, we look at Obama right now and say he's the president, as if, you know, he's the president from his side. But actually, he wasn't born the president. He only became the president, you know, when we elected him, and after he was sworn in. At that time, he really has the name president, and he's able to perform the function of president, and he actually becomes the president. But before we collectively give that name, he isn't the president. Okay? So many things depend upon being merely labeled. And just that idea of, you know, the flower becoming mine. Yeah? Why does it become mine? Well, it became mine because somebody gave it to me. And we've all agreed that when one person who's the owner gives something to another person, that new person becomes the owner, and that new person has now certain privileges. So we have the idea of what mine means, and something that belongs to others we respect. Okay? Supposedly. And we see that when people don't do that, that's when we have a lot of difficulties in society. Okay? But all those kinds of things, you know, what is entailed by stealing? Yeah. These things, kind of all of our minds agree upon them and imbue that with some kind of meaning. So the idea is that things exist in relationship to the mind. They don't exist out there on their own, having their own essence, independent of any mind that perceives them. Okay? So because things are dependent, they are not independent. Because dependent and independent are mutually exclusive. Okay? So if things are dependent, they're not independent. And independent is the meaning of inherent. So independent existence, inherent existence, they mean the same thing. It means independent of any other factor. Able to stand on its own, under its own power. Okay. And so here's where we get that if things were independent, they would have to be permanent. Because if they're independent, they're not only, you know, they're independent of any other factor, so not only the mind that conceives and labels them, but also they're independent of causes and conditions. Anything that's independent of causes and conditions is permanent. So if things were really inherently existent, then they would have to be permanent. Yeah. And they aren't. Yeah. So this acts as a rebuttal that disproves inherent existence. Okay. So we're getting into the third of fourth. We'll talk a little bit more about nirvana next session. Okay? But maybe now, you know, try and go around and just look at how your mind conceives and labels things. And it's very interesting, you know, how a lot of our education is learning labels. Mm-hmm. And what is, you know, when we talk about a court case or something, that's about deciding what label you're going to give, innocent or guilty. Yeah? Wars are fought over labels. Do you call this piece of dirt mine or do you call it yours? Okay? So how we label things and how we relate to the labels is very important. There's nothing actually wrong with labeling itself. A labeling allows us to function together as human beings sharing things. So labeling is not the problem. Yeah. But when we think that the objects exist from their own side, independent of the label, and then we pile all sorts of other stuff on top of it, then that is what breeds attachment and anger. And when other people pile different stuff on top of what, on top of the label than what we've piled, they've piled mine and we've piled mine, then we fight over whose it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so keep this in mind and we'll continue this afternoon.